At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast. It's where we look for all the real magic hidden behind the Mickeys or something like that. This is Matt here. As always, joining me is Thomas, the paranoid American. Howdy.
That's me, paranoid as ever.
Feeling paranoid.
I kind of like that intro. I know it always changes up a little bit. I like what you were working on in that one. I think maybe keep developing that one.
Yeah. I'll just keep rocking out. What I like to do is just not think at all about what I'm going to say before I do the intro. And the problem is I won't remember it. I'll have to go back and listen, you know? Today we are getting to the end of the movies where Disney, the dude, is actually involved. It's The Jungle Book. He was more involved with this one than the last few films, but died before they finished it. So, anyway, it's kind of a capstone, at least to the Walt Disney legacy. From here on, the company goes its own way.
And from some of the other videos and articles and documentaries that I saw about this movie in particular, Jungle Book, they all sort of posed it as the last movie that Walt Disney personally oversaw. So is there another one that came after this one that might be like another last one, or is this in fact the last one that he had an active role in?
He had a more active role in this one. He had felt we talked before, like, he wasn't completely happy with 101 Dalmatians and Sword in the Stone, but he was also busy with Disneyland and his TV show. So
then chronologically, this is the last major motion animated movie that Walt Disney personally sort of, you know, acted as.
Right. And the point ultimate, was,
yeah, okay.
Yeah. The buck stops with him, but since he wasn't completely happy with the last two, he was more involved in this one. Although he did not want the jazz in it, but he was dead, so they put it in anyway. I guess personally, just like in my own Disney dorkdom, I usually consider the capstone being the Epcot video, because that was recorded a month and a half before Disney died, I think, with the big map of Epcot. That's great. I love that.
The video. One where he was presenting the Epcot as like a legitimate option for society, right? Like everyone.
Yeah.
A little bubble city. Right.
Yeah. And that one, if you just take, there's about 30 sentences he says in there, where if you took it out and put it out of context, you would have some pretty wild stuff. Like, oh my God.
Don't tempt me, man. I've been playing with voice AI, so don't tempt me.
Oh, you should. You'll hear some of the most wildly fascist quotes, but you know, it's in the Walt persona, you know, America's daddy voice. So it's like, oh, okay, must be okay. You know, and everyone's going to live to control the host. You know, like,
and if you become lame or lose function of your left arm and can no longer contribute to this functional society, then you'll be escorted out and you won't see your friends and family anymore.
Then you're going to have to live in Celebration. Which,
what a sad, I kind of wish that, you know, we could get Walt's opinion on what Celebration actually is. Cause for anyone that's not aware, Celebration is sort of like a suburb right outside Disney that was about as close as anyone legitimately tried to, like, I didn't even want to call it like Epcot, because it's really just a place that rich people go and live. That's just like on the side of this highway. It happens to be isolated by maybe a half mile drive into this little fake downtown. And then the rest of it's just typical townhouses and regular houses. But it is just so far away from the actual concept of Epcot. So I would kind of like to just hear Walt Disney rant on it. Maybe that's the first one we should try.
And Disney doesn't even own that anymore. I think they sold it like 15 years ago. So yeah.
But really, you wouldn't live there unless you were obsessed with Disney. It would be weird to live in Celebration, not because of Disney making it like the main reason that you decided to go there.
Possibly. Well, you have you do have closer access to the parks, I suppose. So, but yeah, I think I heard someone living there saying like, it's actually more convenient to go to downtown Disney and shop than to shop in Celebration or something. Cause it's just, you know, it never really completely took off the ground, it seems.
Yeah. Well, Celebration has mostly restaurants and then a bunch of like little touristy shops and like a movie theater. But it's not like an actual downtown to, you know, go and get things you would need. There's no hardware store. There's no liquor store. There's no grocery store. So yeah, you're leaving the mainland.
Yeah. So, you know, I do remember being in Orlando once or twice back in the day and think, oh, we should, I can't be bothered to check that out. So
what, Celebration?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know,
I mean, curious, just look at it on Google Maps. That's, you don't need a much bigger experience than that, unless there's something really specific you wanted to see there.
I think that covered it for me. But yes, we will get, so anyway, that's the sorry end to the original Epcot concept. The real end of the Epcot concept, of course, is Guardians of the Galaxy, but as I believe that ride is now opened. Yeah, I don't know. I do like, I'm definitely one of those keep Epcot weird guys, probably because my parents took me when I was like 4 or 5 years old to early 80s Epcot. So
yep, same here.
I was, once you were there, it's like, well, how could you like modern Epcot? I mean, I could have fun on the Guardians ride, I'm sure, but you know, there's no,
and it's interesting too, like
I heard that maybe there are.
This is one of my favorite parts of, I think this was on the main park, but they had like the Tomorrowland, and it was kind of built around with that same sort of concept as when Epcot was built. But if like your parents went and saw it, it really was Tomorrowland, and it really was like very futuristic and impressive. And then when I went as a kid, it was almost a little bit funny because they were talking about dishwashers and vacuum cleaners, and like this was going to be a new wave of the future. But it felt like it was intentionally a little bit campy. But now if you were to go back and watch that same thing, it would just seem so dingy and outdated and everything. So there's some nostalgia aspect to it. But yeah, all those old rides just get phased out eventually.
Tokyo,
we talked about before, the place I worked is now replaced with a Star Wars ride.
Tokyo now has currently has a very old school Tomorrowland. I mean, it looks like 1983 Tomorrowland. They never changed it. And they keep it nice and clean. It doesn't look dingy. But I heard they're going to actually rebuild Space Mountain and for the tune of $500 million. So I'm going to guess they're making some changes to Tomorrowland soon. So
to yours, you mean?
Tokyo Space Mountain. They're going to, I don't know if they're going to actually destroy the building and build a new one or just gut it. But one of those two. And there's, the budget's like $500 million. Excuse me, not $500 million.
Yeah, the last time I went to Space Mountain, that one also looked like it displayed its age a little bit.
Oh, this was 2005 is the last time I went to the Magic Kingdom, but I remember I'd been to Tokyo a few times before that, and it's just like the Magic Kingdom is like undoable after you've done Tokyo, unless you just can't handle the Japanese. But I mean, as in language wise, that sounds a little bit, yeah, can't handle the Japanese. But no, it's just like everything's like in good condition there. Everything's clean. Yeah. The food is actually good. So I don't think I've never eaten decent food at the Magic Kingdom.
You know, but what though? I want to put this one out here because there are places you can go in the Magic Kingdom and on the park, and a lot of them are actually executed by very high level chefs. What it is that the taste of all of the bumpkins that go to Disney is just the worst palate ever. So that even if you were to present like a really nice and well-cooked meal that wasn't just something normal, you're always going to be like, you know, can I get this with French fries? You know, bring me the ketchup. So it's less of the Disney not knowing how to make good food. Like you have to find and like, you know, go to the exact places that have it. But they cater to the average palate. And the average palate in Orlando and through tourism is just absolute garbage.
Oh, yeah, man. I've had, I don't remember the name, but there's a table service place in the middle of Animal Kingdom that's quite good. A few of the Epcot, you know, some of the World Showcase places are pretty good. But and just like Tokyo Disney, you can go to the counter service and that's good. So, you know, which is definitely, I mean, it could be the case in Orlando now, but I kind of doubt it.
It's hit and miss. You have to you have to know exactly where to go if you want actual food versus what essentially all comes from the same kitchen. It'll look like four different restaurants, but they all just share the same kitchen and then kind of like make the same kind of food. You want to avoid those specific types.
Yeah. So I did find, just to get us back to the Jungle Book, I think I found a picture of myself with King Louie somewhere here. So, but like the last time we went, I guess it was my wife and my belated honeymoon. We did Orlando, and just like anytime we'd see a monkey, we'd get a picture with the monkey, you know? So,
I'm drawing a blank. Were there any Jungle Book specific rides anywhere in the parks? I don't remember any.
I don't think there were any attractions, but while we were talking retro, the Mickey Mouse Review, which was in Orlando in the 70s, ended up in Tokyo and only closed maybe 10 years ago. I saw it. That was a weird retro blast. It has like something like 45 animatronics, but they had a Ka, a snake, as one of the electronics. I remember heavily featured. I think it was like Ka plays the flute, which is kind of weird. So, but yeah, the most presence I've seen was in Animal Kingdom, where they would just have a bunch of monkeys, basically.
My least favorite park by far is Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, I guess I've only been there once, and everything was like new, so it was pretty exciting when I went.
It's the least happy and the most smelly of all of the Disney parks.
Well, it's got animals,
for obvious reasons.
I've heard it called a heat sink for sure. I'm trying to make sure I got the right monkey here. This is very old school. I have all my photos. See, I'm looking for a photo on an audio podcast. Anyway, yeah, I got a picture of King Louie in there somewhere, and it's fun. And that's the main point. I feel like I'm not sure how much I saw this movie as a kid. I definitely know the Jungle Book well. This one is not one that I like didn't know the contours of or anything like that. We have it on the Blu-ray, so I must have put it on several times for my daughter. And I asked in the car if anybody remembered the live action version from 2016, if they remember that. And they're like, yeah, that was hot garbage, but they liked the animated one. So definitely tracks with the general Disney flow of live action remakes, I guess. I don't remember
that. Have you ever seen the original movie that came before the animated one?
That 42 Technicolor one?
Correct. Yeah. Have you ever seen that one?
Now that I've just cited it, no, I've never seen that one. I didn't see the 90s one either, so because they did that 90s one, which I guess was still Disney.
No, so. I'm interested because when I was watching one of the documentaries on this one, they were talking about how Walt would go around to the animators and the writers and everyone working on it, even the Sherman brothers, and would ask them, have you ever read this book? You know, the actual Jungle Book. And if they said no, he'd be like, good, don't, you know, like we're making a different movie. But it was interesting that like that was the approach on it.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. It's still done today. Let's take this property and just like not do what you're supposed to do with it. You know, sometimes it's fun. We're about to get the
I had a lot of that imperialism, and I had a little of like darkness and occultism in it. I wonder if the original movie had that. So I'm definitely going to check it out.
Oh, I would say probably it's not like this. From what I understand, it's not the same flavor as you might find in this one, but it's got its own stuff going on. It was in one of the top three movies, I think, the year it came out. And this one also being quite successful. This was easily the most successful. I think Disney had been for about 10 years by this point when they put out 67's Jungle Book. So.
Oh, micromanagement actually did something, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He kicked him into gear a little bit. I mean, I think you don't like Sword in the Stone anymore, but you used to. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with
it. I still like it. It's just no longer my number one. It's no longer possibly ever going to be my number one.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's fair enough for that. This one's always kind of sat in the middle for me. I like it. It didn't go on as much as some of the other ones. I think I said in our Dumbo episode, that was the one that got played the most. In the much later, I think, like, was it 2010 or something, Winnie the Pooh movie? That got played a lot, too. So I remember those being the top hits when my daughter was a tyke. So, but the Jungle Book made a few views. And yeah, this seems like one I would have seen just in the matinee. like, you know, when they take all the kindergartners to the movie theater on a summer afternoon to shut them up for a bit, or let them scream at the screen in a movie theater. I don't remember what happened, but
I mean, on a rewatch, this one was surprisingly better than I remembered it being. I think the songs were a lot better, a lot of earwigs in this one, which I think is probably why a lot of people remember it, because the songs, unlike some of the previous ones, almost, I mean, I guess it's subjective, but everyone on this one's a banger, maybe save for one or two that I probably could have done without or that I don't remember as well.
Yeah, I mean, Bare Necessities, obviously, not by the Sherman Brothers, actually. I think they tweaked it, but that was actually from a different writer who...
Well, it was from the original writer that wrote a lot darker one. I was trying to find some of the darker ones, and one of them is like, we must find freedom, otherwise, like, we'll find death or something like that. So
it definitely had rage, a much... I'm still just
yeah, in a cage. It was some angsty guy writing. But actually, I want to say that Bare Necessities, again, rewatching it through the lens of this show, I have major moral and ethical objections to Bare Necessities. And it almost felt like this is the song that Soros is just putting out into the world. Like, you might as well add a chorus about, and you won't own anything and you'll be happy and we're all going to eat ants and you're all going to eat, you know, crickets and cockroaches for protein and you're going to love it. I kind of felt there was some vibes of that coming.
Well, the problem is you said it, you didn't sing it. You're gonna yeah, not own right. And you are gonna love it. So you gotta do it. So I was just, as we're recording this, the Star Trek's back on TV again, Picard, and they mentioned like money and stuff again. And you're always like, how does money work in Star Trek? Because they're like, we don't have money, which I guess means it's like the Soros thing, like they don't own anything. But then if they go outside of the Federation, suddenly they need money. So how does that work? Are you like trapped within the system that way? You know,
well, and it's funny too. I mean, this is actually a little niche that gets entertaining, but they can just basically materialize anything, right? So they just have this ability to create money, like just counterfeit money and cause inflation. So the economies that they do have the chance to interact with, they can just destroy them on contact because there's no real financial ties to, like, you know, provide some guidance or even prevent them from doing something tragic to an economic system because they operate outside of one. So that's always funny. Like, for example, you go to like Earth, modern day Earth, they could just start printing money and then just throw the entire economy out of balance and buy everything up if they really wanted to. But since they're, you know, the all knowing and all smart Federation and they decide when you get to graduate into the real world, then it's probably like beneath them to even consider the ramifications of doing that.
No, I just watched an old Voyager episode where they come across a planet where a couple of Ferengi have you know, the profit motivated aliens have crash landed on this like planet with a, you know, pre-warp civilization, but they had a replicator, so they've made themselves God. So people come and pray to them, and then they go to the machine and give them what they want, or just the rules of acquisition if they don't feel like giving them what they want.
I did love Voyager. That was also the one where they expanded on the secret society. There's like an Illuminati run by artificial intelligence, and like the Omega Directive or something, because there's the Prime Directive.
Oh, yeah.
Which
is
essentially the one where you won't interfere and you won't, you know, cause harm and things like that. But then the Omega Directive is like, don't worry about the Prime Directive. That's essentially the Omega Directive. If you ever see this forbidden fruit, ignore all the rules and go after it.
And I'm a like ridiculously diehard Trekkie, but yeah, even for me, I'm like, well, is that so great? I mean, it certainly looks great watching these shows and stuff, but yeah.
Well, you know what? It would be great if you're a company man. If you can toe the company line and play in the system, there's no better system in the world. But if you just don't want to show up to work that day, you just want to like sleep in or just not, you know, not play along, like the Federation's not really for you. And I wonder what happens to those people, like the ones that don't, you know, toe the company line. Like, where are they all living? Like, do they also agree that, oh yeah, no money's great? Or are they all just in like some homeless planet that the Federation just ships everybody to, and they just have to like fight for themselves there?
the backwater planets, all that sort of stuff. So anyway, yeah, that's bare necessities. Okay. Very cat. But, you know, we were talking about how Merlin was kind of grooming young author and sort of stuff. I'm like, well, Baloo's kind of doing the same thing in this movie. And he's
he is a little bit. And but it's actually the God, what's the name? I'm already blanking on the name. The Black Panther, also with name B. But he's sort of the real wise old man mentor. And then Baloo comes along, and Baloo is almost like the 20-year-old kid that's still in high school and is still gonna have to repeat next year, but he's like really fun, but doesn't really care about anything. And that's probably why he's so fascinated with just the bare necessities, right? You don't need a job, just collect that government check and just do whatever you want. We'll just eat ants and be free. And meanwhile, the actual mentor is thinking like, I can't compete with this. You know, it's this dumb kid fighting with an even older, bigger, dumber kid. Like, let me just, you know, hope for the best and see what happens here.
See, I that's interesting because I read Baloo, and I'm bringing up his name here because I also forgot it because it was mildly weird with the name
Bagheera.
Oh, thank you. Okay, there we go. But yeah, I felt like they were like kind of peers almost. I and Baloo being more like your Barney Rubble, like he's technically a full grown man, but he's not, you know.
Maybe, although Barney Rubble was technically as successful or even more so than Fred Flintstone was. So not only were they peers, but they were equal peers. In this movie, Baloo is just like the one that doesn't care. Like, he's just, I don't know. I'm struggling to find a better way to compare Bagheera and Baloo, but Bagheera is like the serious one that's actually trying to train this kid, and Baloo's just like, let's just dance and eat honey and eat ants and sing songs.
It's like the Simpsons where Bart goes to the Indian casino and sees 15 years into however many years into the future. So Baloo's like the trying to play rock with Ralph Wiggum or whatever. And
okay, yeah, no, I like that. Yeah, I
and
like
then this. You got like Lisa Simpson, sure, as the president. They definitely died on equal terms there. But yeah, anyway, that's the big earworm. And that's the thing, Baloo is very likable. I mean, I think we got a picture with Baloo somewhere on there as well. So,
and Baloo has to be the inspiration. Well, first he graduates a little bit in Robin Hood into the sidekick. I'll have to remember all the names when we actually get to that movie. Was it Prince John or not Little John? But he ends up being like one of the king guy. And then he also turns into Tailspin, I believe. I'm pretty sure that's the main character in Tailspin came from Baloo.
That is correct. So there's a place where, not in the parks, but yeah, this continues to go on. I did notice, just doing my notes the entire time, I confused Mowgli with Mogwai, you know, the from Gremlins, and also the name of a post.
How did you get that confused?
I don't know, but I realized I think I've been confusing the two my entire life. I just... Yeah.
Oh, you've always been calling the kid Mogwai?
Yeah, yeah. I thought the band named itself after Jungle Book, but it's Gremlins. So, yeah. So, oh, well.
And apparently Mowgli, there was two ways to pronounce it. There's Mowgli and then there's Mowgli. And there was a fight over, not like a fist fight, I don't think, but
I was hoping
between the actual pronunciation and then when Disney adapted it. He like intentionally changed the name. I mean, I've got some notes on this that I think Disney intentionally occulted some of the story here, and that's why he didn't want people to read it, and that's why he wanted to kind of distance it and turn it into this nice, beautiful, family friendly thing with just a bunch of earwigs in it, because he wanted that older, darker book to just live longer than I think it would have without it.
Okay, I guess we should get a bit into Kipling at this point then, which I, you know, obviously he's a well-known figure, but I intentionally didn't go delving into him before this podcast because I thought you might have something. So what do you got?
So for anyone that's not aware, Kipling was like a British author. He loved India and he was just huge into sort of occultism and mysticism. And he believed that India was the true central origin of human consciousness, essentially, and that all the secrets were essentially hidden somewhere in India, and he was just fascinated with that for his whole life. And he shared this fascination with a friend of Helena Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, who's the one that essentially is credited, arguably, with bringing just all Eastern esotericism into the Western world. And that's where you get Crowley from, and it's where you get the Theosophical Society from, and it's where you get maybe World War II from on some levels. And this guy was a member of the Theosophical Society, and I think he joined it in the late 1880s and remained a member for his entire life. So it would be an understatement to say that he was into occultism. He was like the most OG into occultism before people even knew what occultism had just been invented, essentially, in like a global Western, you know, unrevealed scheme. He was sort of one of the forefront, you know, founders of all of that. So it's just really interesting that Walt Disney seemed to like seek out these books. Apparently Walt, and by the 30s, he already had pinned this book as like, I want to work on this. And then it took another three decades to actually start on something.
Well, I mean, that happens with a lot of these things. They had a working plans for Frozen in like 1940, but you know, it's what you get through the pipe. But yeah, I guess I've always thought of Kipling as being like Captain Imperialism, you know. So I do.
Well, that's just part of it. So the occultism is what makes him fascinated with India, and vice versa. It's just like this Ouroboros of I love India. So he finds this occultism, and then he falls in love with the occultism, but then he attributes it to the Eastern world because that was sort of in the time, because everyone knew about paganism and the Romans and the Greeks, and you know, it was like old school. So finding all of this Eastern mysticism, and specifically it being translated into English and other European languages, it was this new big boon for occultism that I pretty much we're still embracing today, like all the tarot and constellations and horoscopes, and a lot of that basically stems from this Theosophical Society. So again, it would be an understatement to not mention how incredibly big role that played in all of Kipling's kind of work. So that being said, some of the things that he worked on immediately after joining the Theosophical Society, from the same author of The Jungle Book. So he had he wrote a bunch of several stories on occult and supernatural. One was actually called The Mark of the Beast, and then one was called The Phantom Rickshaw, and he was trying to get into supernatural horror. And I think this is one of the reasons that Disney wanted to distance himself a little bit from the original Jungle Book and all the other stuff that Kipling had worked on, because outside of poetry and the Jungle Book, he really did focus on like macabre sort of stories and horror supernatural stuff that tied in all these occult elements.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Yeah, I don't know. Could Disney do Edgar Allan Poe? I'm just thinking of a lifetime macabre.
I mean, he was into just killing parents right off the bat, but I think that maybe he was just trying to be a little bit more light-handed with it. And some of the original storyboards for the initial concept for this movie, Jungle Book, they were so much cooler looking than I think what we ended up with, because again, we got sort of the one that you pop in with your kids in the living room and it turns into a babysitter and you don't worry too much about it because it's all sort of, you know, G-rated. But that the original storyboards, like they were traveling through these kind of lost temples and the places that you would imagine Blavatsky and her little crew having to go and unreveal these hidden civilizations and finding these big skull mountains and like peel back the moss hair and like go into the nostril, like all of that stuff was in those original storyboards. So it would have been really cool to see that more occulted version for sure.
Yeah, I guess for my reading, I do a lot of reading, but I've always had a very strong wall between me and Victorian era writing. I can't get through it. I've never gotten through any actual Blavatsky, you know?
Well, it's not an easy read for sure, but it was before people even really knew how to put chapters together in a way that people wanted to read it, not just for organization, but for being conducive to wanting to be a page turner, even if it's kind of reference material. But back then it was just like blah, 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 blah. And the chapter would just go on forever and ever. Like, because what else did you have to do, right? Like, most people did go to a 4-hour lecture. It's not like they had a game waiting for them at home or anything else going on. So it reflects a lot of that. But again, it's so interesting because it's this very occult knowledge that even in the 30s, when Walt falls in love with the Jungle Book, no one's really as hip to the actual origins of all that. I mean, 30s, there's definitely a revival of occultism and the Art Nouveau and like all the Egyptian and Egyptology influence. People started getting into it again, but a lot of it was aesthetic, and it wasn't necessarily reading the actual works of Blavatsky and the things that Kipling was into. So he tapped into the actual backstory, and then again Walt's just like, yep, we're gonna take that and we're just gonna make it look fun and cartoony, and bam, now that's part of culture for the next 100 years plus.
I'm sitting here thinking I couldn't do Blavatsky, but I could get through Manly P. Hall okay. Maybe it's just hearing
well, American, that's the magic of Manly P. Hall, man. He had that knack of putting things in one of the first Manly P. Hall books I read, he was making this analogy to occultism, to like walking down a city street and going window shopping and deciding like what suits you'd wear and what jewelry you'd buy. And then he was talking about like, this is how people look at a lot of this knowledge and stuff. But his analogies, it's always like, imagine you're a blue collar working person walking down a street and you look into a window. Like, no other sort of esoteric writer would have ever been that casual, because they always like to keep this esteem of like, you know, like occulted mystery and mysticism and like all this advanced knowledge. And Hall would always just bring it down to like a regular casual conversation level. So that is the thing that made him unique.
I'm just sitting here wondering if that might be part of what had such a resurgence in the 30s. Not that everyone was out reading the secret teachings of all ages, but enough people did to, you know, influence other people. And it was maybe a little more trendy in the 30s, because now you could like kind of understand this stuff. Because the 1890s version definitely seems like we're going to be sitting in a drawing room, you know, speaking in hushed, serious tones about this stuff.
Well, I've got some other theories without going too much on tangents, but prior to the advent of the internet, essentially, or Barnes and Noble, even, right? We'll just say Barnes and Noble or like bookstores. But like maybe before the 1970s, when sort of fringe bookstores became really popular, comic books and underground scenes, you had to be just wealthy and have lots of free time to even be interested in the occult, because A, it meant that you didn't have like a normal job, because being real deep into the occult, unless everyone else that you worked with was also, it could get you kind of blackballed from, you know, certain communities and other things like this. But then on top of that, it's not like you just had access to these books or that they were cheap. A lot of these books were very expensive. You had to do it through mail order. You had to order from like very specific places, and they were all very ornate and intricate. They didn't have a lot of like the cheap paper, you know, mass produced paperback edition of Secret Teachings of All Ages. Actually, that might not be the best example, because I think Manly P. Hall intentionally tried to make stuff cheaper, but like his library would have been cost a fortune to get access to. So this ends up being, you know, Manly P. Hall, but also lots of government employees that are just banking off stuff. And then a lot of Hollywood who start becoming the first kind of wave of celebrities that have all this extra expendable money. And that's kind of why occultism takes off in those communities, because they've got the time and the money to get involved with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just thinking part of the whole London scene was, the Beatles getting involved with the Indica bookstore or something, which was, you know, in London, you can get this sort of stuff. I mean, there's the expensive private Victorian era bookstore, too, but this was supposed to be the more like young and hip place. And that's
one of those places that a lot of the way that they were able to get all that information, stay those places, is there was like, man, I don't know enough about British rock history, but I know that there was this story that it was like a certain building that someone owned. And just over time, like 20 or 30 huge musicians would just roll through there and live there and work out of there. And it was like right in the center where everything was at, or all the studios were at and all the artists were at. So they literally just had like a building that if you were into, you know, occultism and music and art and sort of all this underground scene, then you just had a place to live and stay right there in the middle of town. And that's what facilitated so much of that connection with occultism and rock music in those days.
I think there might be more than one instance of that. I know at the UFO Club and early Pink Floyd, that's how that got started. But it was originally supposed to be like, oh, this is kind of a philosophist school, you know, maybe magical. But once the band started taking hold and everyone was doing tons of acid there, which actually the band didn't do much of except for Sid Barrett. But, you know, once everyone was just getting whacked out and grooving in the music became the thing and not the the school aspect. So, you know,
I mean, that sounds way more boring, right? Like, who wants to read these old ancient, like, even you said, like the Victorian writing of occultism, it's not like the easiest thing to digest versus, you know, listen to someone pick a guitar solo out while you're taking acid. So yeah, you can't read, you're not going to read a lot of Victorian occultism on acid and take away a lot from it, I don't think.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Getting to the movie a little bit, I'm sure we'll get back to Kipling some, but I was thinking about the animation. This one's kind of interesting because all the animations look good. The backgrounds look great. They don't always seem to match each other.
There's also no shadows at all. They were just like, we're not going to worry about shadows. In some of the previous movies, the shadows were inconsistent. Sometimes there, sometimes not. Sometimes not necessarily matching the right shades. But on this one, a majority of the movie, there's just no shadows casted by the characters at all, which was, it stood out to me.
That might have been what got me, because I was just, for a lot of sequences, like, in a way, I could appreciate the animation more because I could just clearly tell it cells on top of a background, you know?
Yeah, but they weren't integrated into that background. Like, the background didn't affect them and they didn't affect the background as much as some of those previous movies, I think.
Okay, it wasn't just me then. That's cool.
And another thing too, and this one bugged me, and I have a note on, like, how spoiled am I to complain about this old school style of hand-drawn cell animation that just takes forever and no one will really ever reproduce it again. But that being said, there were some frames where it's like, I can see the pencil marks that didn't get fully erased on some of these cells. And I don't know if it's because I was watching like the Disney Timeless Collection edition that might have been, you know, like upscaled versions of original cells, and maybe like the original release didn't show it as clearly. You know, it's like when you see the pores on a character's face because they, like, you know, remastered the film from like the 80s, and it's like, oh yeah, they actually had pores on their face. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, that also stood out to me, and it was like with the 101 Dalmatians too. And I don't know if maybe it's just still adapting to new technology and just getting caught in how fast it is, or maybe once they scanned it, it would have been extra effort to get rid of those like half erased lines that made it all the way through. But they stood out to me, and it was like, oh, that's a little bit messy.
I remember somewhere in the mid-90s, my father and I went to see the IMAX Rolling Stones thing, and my dad's comment walking out of there was like, I could count the nose hairs in Mick Jagger's nose. So what was I watching? It's a Blu-ray from, I don't think it's Timeless Collection, but it's a 2014 Blu-ray. But this was driving me mildly insane because every once in a while I'd want to look something up or make a note, like, and pause the movie. Did you pause the movie?
Actually, I mean, mine was had some issue where it was broken up from like the Blu-ray menus. So every time it changed scene, it would stutter a little bit. So I explicitly saw like the break between every scene. So
that wasn't the problem I had. It was when I wanted to pause the movie to make a note or maybe just think about something for a moment. it would go into, when you pause the movie, it doesn't just pause. It goes into this other side trip where Baloo goes on some kind of weird monologue for about 30 seconds. And really? Then he goes into a song. I'm like, it's like, no, I want to think. I don't want sound and vision so right now. That's why I paused the movie. So I felt like I was getting mind controlled, tortured by Disney in that way. And then I'd like forget why I paused the movie, you know?
So it worked.
Yeah. So, oh, because I wrote Everyone Loves Baloo or Dewey. You can't just pause this movie. It goes into a weird, okay, what I just said. So,
yeah, I don't know if I love Baloo. I still feel like he was the one that possibly could have led this whole thing stray. He almost got Mowgli killed. He himself almost dies and then doesn't take his own death very seriously. So he comes away to me as like, oh, I'm not going to say a bad guy, but a bad influence for sure.
Okay, he's a bad influence. I'll give him
that. He's the Huckleberry, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Although I was just... who mentioned that? At the end of Huckleberry Finn, where I think Jim is trapped in the smokehouse, and Huckleberry, in that case, I believe is the voice of reason, where he's like, why don't we just dig a hole underneath and let him out? And Tom Sawyer is the one coming up with like insane plans that make no sense.
I mean, it's a fair point. I think Huckleberry was more street smart.
Sometimes when you're, I guess, more lazy, it helps. You know, there's a certain edge to being lazy sometimes because your plans are less convoluted.
Oh, man, I wish I could remember the exact quote on command here, but it's like, laziness is the best breeder of ingenuity or something like that. Or laziness breeds ingenuity.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's supposed to be getting back to the Beatles. That was the whole John Lennon thing. Apparently he was part of the genius was him finding the simplest way to do things because he was lazy.
Yeah.
So that's cool. I can get that. What else do we have in here? We got the elephants, the military elephants. That's pretty, I mean, that is the imperialism, like coming straight through. But then it's in the elephant, so it's native. So are they like conscripted troops? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it works out, right? Because they can't be imperialist if that's their native land, which kind of is the exact opposite of imperialism, is it doesn't happen from within, right? It's this outside force that imposes its will on you. But the rest of this movie... Man, the Disney did a good job again of occulting it and whitewashing it a little bit, but man, that the original book and some of the quotes from it and just Kipling's attitude in general, it essentially just boils down to, yes, this area, and in the book or in the movie, it's the jungle, right? These jungle animals, like, they're noble and they've got great information and insight, but we're still superior, and it's up to us. And this is what Kipling called the white man's burden, which I think is the original place where this came from, that phrase of the white man's burden. And that it basically, like, you had to send your sons out to these horrible places like India, his words, not mine, in order to sort of tame the natives and show them how to be civilized. And that was the white man's burden, was that you had to lose your own life and your own kid's life to help civilize the rest of the world and bring them up to the British imperial standards. And you definitely get that air of authority. And these, you know, the elephants specifically kind of mention that, right? They're making sure everyone's in line. Everyone's like posing. It's kind of like that military breakdown of make sure everyone is the exact same type of shape. Even give someone a haircut on demand.
I mean, you still get that today. I was sent a review copy, so I read the Prince Harry book, where he's kind of still got that kind of attitude, but at the same time, he's trying to sound, you know, kind of woke as well. So he ends up sounding like crazy.
I love you're selling it a little bit, to be honest. Now I'm interested.
Yeah, he's like, I killed this many people in Afghanistan, which made the headlines. But then he's talking about these weird, like, hunting. What is the Scottish summer home that the royals have, Balmoral or something? He's talking about these hunting scenes. And I'm just sitting there thinking, you know, they could have, if you want to get this wild conspiratorial and be like, oh, they were hunting people, that kind of takes, that kind of works.
Now, is this the same place that the Queen would stay and Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell? Have you seen that? There's like a picture of them both staying at the same cottage.
If it was summer, probably. So yeah, that was my point though. They got this summer palace like in the middle of the Highlands or whatever, Scotland. And you know, I found just reading Prince Harry's book fascinating because he's trying to talk about his experiences there, but some of it seems like intentionally vague, you know. Of course, that's my whack mind probably reading into, or not, I don't know. So yeah, maybe.
No, I mean, I think he's got an interesting past here, because didn't he also get caught in the early 2000s wearing like a Nazi uniform to some party? So he was clearly an edgelord, like way back in the day. Harry was absolutely the edgelord. Like, there's no question about that.
And that yeah, he actually does address that in the book, and you can take his reason or not, but yeah, which I
he think didn't was, know. So someone got him drunk, and they dressed them for him, and he had no idea what was going on.
Well, his excuse is that I maybe he heard about the costume thing late, and he went, and the only place he could rent was like that or a pilot's uniform. So he asked his brother which one, and you know, yeah, maybe that was
he
blamed his brother, kind of. He says, I was in a rush, and Kate and Willie were like,
yeah, maybe. Although I'm pretty sure the pictures that I've seen were like him blackout drunk wearing this, so
that's the way to wear it. I mean, it was not wrong in that case. Anyway, it was one, it's easy to read because it's well ghost written, so you can, you know, crack through the thing in a few hours, even though it's got a lot of pages. So but yeah, I was just kind of fascinated because all the headlines are coming like, no, this is, I want to see what this actually says, you know? So again, with the Jungle Book, like if you're watching this movie, you're not really getting what it actually says, because this book from 100 years earlier has a very different, you know, vibe than we're going to have sing along time with the family.
Yeah. So we can get into some of the more of my serious notes here. Man, there's so many things to vibe on. But I want to cut straight to some of the more interesting notes, and then we can go back to joking a little bit. But one of them, I took this because comparing the types of works that Kipling himself was interested in, he clearly believed in a lot of Indian philosophy and religion. So this symbol of Mowgli essentially is like this primal kid, right? Right. Like a feral child raised by wolves, literally. Which represents this like base animalistic nature of people. So Mowgli in this movie is the native that imperialism is tasked to sort of train. And that's him having to go to like the Man City. And that's why it's like this big trek. And that's the big ending is he gets reunited and then decides he wants to go back into the jungle essentially. And even that's kind of what the song is about, of bare necessities, is like, don't worry about the human world, stay here in this primal world. But at the same time, all these other animals realize, like even King Louis represents like someone that is aware that they're in Plato's cave essentially, and that Mowgli is his ticket. And he's talking about, I want the man's red fire, which is could be basically enlightenment. Like, I'm this monkey and I want what humans have, which is enlightenment. But ironically, the human is obsessed with staying in like this base animalistic nature. So that's what the original book is pretty much based around. You lose a little bit of that in the movie, but knowing that backstory, you can see it come out in the movie again. But in the book, it's a lot more explicit about all of these kind of challenges and story arcs that the character is going through, and the direct references to the occult and everything is a lot more prevalent.
I think the book have a lot more back and forth between the village and the jungle, like, because, you know,
yeah, it plays a bigger role, because again, it's like man's struggle to, you know, tame these natives, and then also that native of Mowgli representing like the human intellect and maybe not being ready to reach enlightenment, and then maybe getting closer to it on each step.
I mean, I'm sure Kipling was fully aware of, you know, guys going off into Himalayan caves to meditate for like years at a time, which of course that's an older person. I guess that's like the opposite is what I'm getting at there. That's kind of going into the wilderness to seek enlightenment instead.
Kind of. I mean, again, like the from the imperialist standpoint, their enlightenment is going into these areas and helping other people reach enlightenment, because in doing so they learn more about, you know, primitive rituals and how it applies. And but for Kipling and this imperialist attitude, it's all just because it's an outstanding reconfirmation of how superior they are to the animal world and to like these natives that they're basically taming. So the enlightenment is more of like an enlightening pat on the back of like, look what a great job we're doing to make this world better. And it's probably less of, let's just like humbly enter this other culture and observe quietly and respectfully and just take the lessons back. It was very much like, and let's get 1,000 troops over here and just snap them all into line and show them, you know, how a society really works.
Show them how it's really done, for sure. How about some of the other creatures of the forest? I guess we've gotten enough about Baloo. I got it. Okay, here's my note. I assume a jungle bum is just a close cousin to a parrot head. So maybe that's Baloo's energy. Like,
yeah, Baloo's a parrot head.
Yeah, because I've heard those Jimmy Buffett concerts can get like really like old person horny, you know, middle to elderly horny concerts.
Well, I don't know that they've actually have Margaritaville housing resorts. Developments in Florida now.
Yeah, I know.
Well, there's resorts, but there's also like, if you want to just go and retire, you can live at Margaritaville literally.
Well, I have to admit to being an occasional bar fly at the Margaritaville last time I lived in the States, because we lived near a mall, and the Margaritaville was like a 3-minute walk. So
who doesn't like a $20 margarita?
they were cheaper at the time. I'd go for happy hour, you know, because I live next to it. So, and I never paid 20 bucks for one of their margaritas. I don't remember.
So I think Baloo, I've met, and that's the best analogy, truly, is the parrot head Baloo.
So let's, we talked about King Louis a little bit. He once went man has. He once
King fired. Louis. He's also a little bit of a trickster, because he sort of tricks Mowgli into making this like this deal that he's not even realized he's making. And all he gets in return is like a song. And then Mowgli in return has to give him the power of enlightenment, essentially, which is kind of a great deal for King Louis. It was also probably my favorite songs were all from King Louis.
Well, that's Louis Prima singing, right? Which they they caught themselves this time, because he's Italian, right? The original idea was to have a different Louis. They were going to cast Louis Armstrong. And someone, you know, raised up their hand and said, maybe we shouldn't, you know, cast the black man as a monkey. Yeah. People might not like that. So
is that really how that went down, or did it just work out like that?
Pretty much. I think they pretty much like, we can't cast a black man as a monkey. That's not going to be good PR for us.
To be honest, until I started doing research for this episode, I always assumed that it was just some black jazz singer, because it sounds like it. You know what I mean? I never would have guessed it was. No, I want to assume he's Cuban or something.
Yeah. I think he's Italian American,
just pure, right? Italian American. Okay.
But yeah, it's you know, they'd already had Song of the South come out, and that was always controversial, right? So, you know, so let's not step into it again, you know.
so I liked him, and then I think Ka might have been my favorite character in this whole movie as a kid, and maybe even now. I'm not settled one way or the other, but I love his character,
which of course is one of our prime Disney voice actors. I'm sure you recognize. I'm not sure.
Winnie the Pooh, the Stork and Dumbo, the Cheshire Cat. Yeah,
right.
One of my favorite voices for sure.
But I just love the juxtaposition that's Pooh, but this is creepy now. Okay, that's kind of fun.
Well, Pooh's always been kind of creepy.
But... Well, it's supposed to be absolutely terrible, but since, you know, since the copyright is now public domain, there's the British film Pooh, Blood and Honey that just came out.
Yeah, where, I haven't seen it yet.
Where Christopher Robin goes to college and doesn't leave food behind, so Piglet and Pooh go feral and start murdering everybody. But they can't have anything Disney in it. Like, Pooh doesn't have a red shirt, because that's Disney's part of the they still own that IP, right? They just don't own the character himself. So if it looks like the books, you're good to go. You can make your own Pooh movie now if you want.
You said Pooh movie.
Yeah.
So I want to make a note too on Mowgli, because I've been looking for this research multiple times and I can't remember the exact name of it, but there was this study on feral children in the late 90s, I believe. And it was called, I'm going to butcher the name of it, but I'm pretty sure it was called like the bicameral brain theory or the bimanifold brain theory. And every time now that I look up bimanifold, it's just like a bunch of car parts and random, completely unrelated things. But there was this theory that if you were a feral child and you lived in the wilderness and you were truly raised by wolves or whatever other animal that ended up raising you, then there were certain points in your development as a child that if you didn't have human interaction, you'd basically stay in this reverted animal state forever because there was an actual biological difference in the way that your brain formed versus someone else. Like someone that living in society and is learning from other humans and complex human interactions, it increases the plasticity of the brain and it helps actually develop more neural connections and yada, yada, yada. But if you just live among wolves and you never have like the verbal and the nonverbal communication that you would have with animal or, you know, humans. And also if you actually move around on all fours and just destroy your knees and your hands and everything, like there's actual mechanical things that you're no longer developing that you'd expect to see in, you know, like the age of a toddler, or like a young kid. So by the time, long story short, by the time you're like 7 or 8, if you haven't had a lot of human interaction and somehow you miraculously are still alive eating raw flesh with your your wolf, you know, den, there's almost no real way to develop on that. And a little bit like Fargo, but way less progress. Like it just imagine Fargo, but they can't get her to do anything.
Yeah, I mean, even for us, like I still, my Japanese is still garbage. You know, I didn't have a second language growing up, and now trying to get a second language is just, you know, banging my head against the wall. I can study stuff one day, come back the next day and remember like nothing, you know?
Right. You could spend the next 3 or 4 years and get mediocre. But if you had spent those 3 to 4 years when you were 6 through 9, 6 through 10, now all of a sudden, like that would have made a huge impact and you could be fluent, even if you didn't necessarily practice it as much after that. It's weird, but there's absolute, you know, actual proven differences as you're growing up in those ages. And again, we're talking specifically about feral children. It's a point here because he just miraculously like knows English because all the animals know English, which might go into more of that occult, like he can actually talk to the animal spirits and whatnot. But if you just take a look at this kid living in the jungle, he doesn't act like a feral kid at all. If anything, from day one, he's teaching all the animals how to be a human. But where did he learn how to be a human? He didn't.
Yeah, because he had his full on with Moses or Mithras start, right? So almost getting eaten, because it would have made a perfectly fantastic meal as a baby. So that's surprising he didn't get eaten. I wanted to hit what other characters we haven't talked about with Shri Khan yet. For one, I know it's impossible, but I just decided he was voiced by Alan Rickman, who would not have done the voice in the 60s, but it was just such a Rickman vibe, you know.
But and man, there's so many similarities too to the Lion King with this particular dynamic, where in this movie it's Khan and his vultures, and then in Lion King it's basically the hyenas, but they play like the exact same role of playing with the food before it gets eaten kind of deal.
Oh yeah. And I was thinking kind of like Khan's, you know, he's literally like the reverse of Mowgli, because it's like you can have a pet tiger until it gets a certain age, and like you said, then the animal instincts kick in and you can't have a pet tiger anymore. This is not one that you can play with.
Shout out to the Tiger King.
Yeah. I didn't, actually never saw that. I was thinking about Mike Tyson owning tigers in the past, but
he probably got him from the Tiger King. Yeah.
Yeah. Bro. Did he? Okay. That's cool. Anyway. Yeah. A pet tiger sounds fantastic for what, a year? Is that how long you can have your pet tiger and roll around with it? Can't roll around with Khan. He'll slash you.
It's basically until you can stop affording to feed him.
Yeah. And then you get eaten. Yeah, for sure.
But and Khan in this movie, I think interestingly, he's the ego. Khan represents the ego, even to the point where in the making of, they were talking about Khan's character is so full of himself and he's so self-confident that he doesn't even have to act like an actual tiger. You know, like he doesn't do a lot of tiger type things. He's very casual, but that casual attitude you realize is because he knows he's such a badass and that he could just kill you and devour you at any second. So he just, he kind of embellishes in that superiority in a way. And he represents just the pure ego. And the whole book, or at least in this movie, again, it's Mowgli fighting against Khan, essentially. So it's him first has to defeat his ego, and then he has to basically reconcile this human intellect without losing his animal nature.
So what is that? I guess it makes Baloo the id, and perhaps the panther, whose name I'm forgetting yet again, would maybe be our super ego, because he, I mean, what he says should happen is basically what happens at the end, right?
And he sits back and he watches as the id and I guess whatever Mowgli is are like interacting, and it's like, yeah, I'll let you guys, you know, figure this out. You guys got to like work this out of your system.
And in this metaphor, I guess Mowgli is just the basic spirit, the individual, right? And then
the animal spirit, right?
And then we layer on the animals as the actual psychological components. Like, that's an interesting way to look at this. Yeah, sure.
We could do this. We could do a whole Jungian jungle, the Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book. Yeah, okay, I like that. My first one was the Jungle Book, but that's just because it sounds silly.
I like the Jungle Book.
Yo, no, I definitely like that better. Yeah. The last scene of this movie is icky, like just in an icky way.
Yeah, I could just do without it.
I did.
They could have ended it.
Yeah, it was just too many shots of like fluttering eyes from like a 7-year-old girl. I'm like, that's not. That's a little funky. Okay.
And also, if that's another totally thing that bizarre. He learned from his feral wolf pack, it probably wouldn't have turned out good for her. It wouldn't have been a romantic first night out, I don't think.
Yeah, I learned this from the animals. So, but yeah, I definitely just thought that. I mean, I see, that's the thing. It's like, what was the motivation for making that scene exactly? Is it just supposed to be cute?
I think it was. Well, it was to represent that he was finally embracing another human, essentially, because prior to that, he had that same aspect of Khan where Khan didn't like humans. And this kid, he kind of preferred just living in the jungle. So this was that carrot that got dangled of like, hey, there's this sweet 7-year-old, reward waiting for you if you join humanity and let colonialism and imperialism basically, you know, shape you into the man that you're supposed to be. And her song, that's what it was.
Her song is creepy. I'm not down with that song.
Yeah, honestly, like this movie, I feel like I want my own personal version where you just cut that entire section out and the rest of it's good.
I mean, they just have him go into the village. That's fine. Anyway, I
fade to black. Yeah, go. He's heads into the village. Fade to black. You wonder what happens afterwards. And then there was a second Jungle Book book. But I don't think that one got incorporated into a Disney movie. I don't know, actually. Do you know if any of the newer remakes considered that one?
I believe elements of that have made it into most of the remakes. Just sort of kind of like a Alice in Wonderland thing where you can't even remember what's actually in which book anymore if you're watching the film versions, because it's all just a mishmash half the time.
Well, and because Disney decided how he wanted to redefine it, right? It's interesting because Disney is not the creator of these stories, but they're like the authority on these stories now. Like most people familiar with the Jungle Book, I'm going out on a limb and just making a broad assumption here, but most people right now familiar with the Jungle Book are familiar because of the Disney properties and not because anyone's actually reading the original imperialist propaganda version, which still has, you know, it's still a classical work, but it's one of those things that only people that care about reading like the 100 original Victorian novels that everyone should read before they die, they might read this Jungle Book, but I don't think it's making a lot of top 10 lists anywhere.
I feel like very often the genius of creation and the genius of being a pop sensation can be quite different. Like coming up with original ideas, being truly groundbreaking, often is rough edged, right? It's also kind of weird. So you need someone to synthesize it and make it something that everyone can dig. Another Beatles reference, you could argue the Beatles didn't really do anything particularly original. Someone else did it first. their thing was, I guess, synthesizing it and having the massive, you know, pop marketing machine behind them. That probably helped too, I'm sure. But
what, I mean, honestly, on this same note too, like, imagine, I know the timelines wouldn't have matched up, but imagine trying to get Kipling and Walt Disney in the same room trying to work on this story together, and Walt being like, no, get rid of all of the imperialism and the occult stuff. This is like a family friendly thing. It needs to have catchy songs in it. And I think that same analogy is kind of like with the Beatles. Like, the Crowley probably wouldn't have been the guy that would get on the plane because the label told him to, and then the show up and dance like the monkey and sing like the monkey. You know what I mean? Like, do this on command. Crowley would just be messing with their heads. So in order to make that more palpable, the Crowley's teachings make its way into the Beatles' lyrics and their artwork. But the Beatles are that malleable collection of action figures that the companies can just pose and put in front of cameras and sell and market. Whereas all of the, like, the artsy, interesting content of their music comes from a place that would have never presented itself and, like, pose me, you know, put me in front of the camera. And that's what makes them sort of successful, is because they take that information and that content and, like you say, present it in, like, a nice way for everyone to enjoy. But there's something interesting, like, well, how come that original content isn't just mundane, like, let's all just be nice to each other and, you know, shake hands with everyone and everyone smiles? Like, talking about, you know, dark and occult things is what gives it that meat that people want to come back to, right? It's not just all fluff.
Yeah, because I'm, you know, sitting here thinking that Disney himself was extremely aware of this.
He was raised in Démolé, so he was basically a fully qualified Mason without ever having to become a Mason, but he was aware of all of those occult and very subtle undercurrents of, you know, these ancient stories that are just being retold in new ways.
Here, I was searching here for, this is a quote from Walt Disney, by the way. He's referring to himself in the third person.
He says, are we gonna have to beep any of this out?
No.
Okay.
I'm not Walt Disney. I do a lot of things Walt Disney wouldn't do. Walt Disney doesn't smoke. I smoke. Walt Disney doesn't drink. I drink.
Yeah.
Attributed to Walt Disney. So, yeah. You know, he got that, right? He knew, like, you can't go be a Crowleyan madman, you know?
And then, well, you can. You just can't make that the one that people know about.
Well, you can't do that and then be the host of the magical world of color.
But again, we're talking about someone that took two top Nazi scientists, one of them in the SS with, you know, like, awards and honors personally given to him by the Third Reich. And then he becomes like a childhood TV host that everyone aspires to, like, become friends with.
Well, that's the same thing. You know, Werner von Braun wouldn't work for the Nazis, but I did, quoted by Werner von Braun. Excuse me. It's kind of an awkward way to shoehorn that quote in. But I mean, that's just other cases where it's clear, like, okay, we have this fantastic television personality that you're going to play. And that's, people are going to say that's you, right? But you know who you are. Well, or at least you know you're not that guy.
Isn't that so weird, though, that it was, like, obvious and factual, but just the way that it gets presented and the fact that it had the authority of Disney, who was, I mean, weird to say a moral compass, but in some ways he kind of acted as, like, this weird moral compass in the media, even de facto at this point, right? They set the standard of, like, what a G and a PG movie and what a kids movie kind of is. Like, Disney is sort of the official Nintendo seal version of kids movies at this point. Or at least it was when we were growing up. Now there's a lot more competition, I guess. Right. But I think that it's an interesting aspect of that, because, again, like, without Disney, that wouldn't have come to be the same way.
Yeah, I guess that's just one of the first, like, who else would be just, because I'm thinking, you know, classic era movie stars, like, they didn't have as strong a public persona. You'd see them in the movies, you know, you know who John Wayne is, but you don't. In the movies, but you didn't really feel like you knew John Wayne, where everyone felt like they knew Walt Disney, but they knew this guy that was on TV that was not the actual person at all. You know, that guy, the guy on TV, never got pissed off. He always sounded jolly, you know? So anyway,
it helps when you own the studio and you own the cameras and like, right. You know,
no, it helps. Yeah. It helps to have all that, you know, media infrastructure as well. You can't do it without that. That's another thing Crowley didn't have. He might've had like intelligence backing, but that's different than, you know, Hollywood dollars, I guess. That's, you got to keep the intelligence money, like on the down low. That's black op money, right? Whereas maybe you get both when you're the Disney company.
Well, I mean, he definitely got both.
So, but yeah, that's, maybe that's another thing in the Jungle Book, with us framing all the animals as different part of the psyches, and then Mowgli just as the general human spirit, and having to decide how he's going to present himself to the world. And that's, I know that's reading in way too much. I'm just like, you talk about it for an hour and you start coming up with those metaphors, right?
I mean, but this one more so than some of the other, especially, actually, it's hard, man. I was going to say more than 101 Dalmatians, but after I read the sequel about the flying dogs that, you know, time travel and talk to Egyptian deities. but this one does have like the occult undertones aren't ones that you have to seek out and draw these wild connections. Like, it's literally just read the original book, and it's just Eastern mysticism represented in this story mixed with imperialism, which is such an interesting mix, because again, it's like, let's open our minds and then enslave these populations.
Yeah, that's the disconnect. Let's open our minds, right? That's the key thing. Let's not open everyone's mind. They weren't saying namaste to the folks there, and except as maybe a cultural bone to throw.
You have to say this right before you take all their possessions. Just say namaste and it's all good.
I see the God in you, and now this God's taken out all that stuff. So my God is better than your God, right? That being me. I'm having to look through if I have any other fun notes. Oh, here's a fun. I wrote Dr. Ewan Snakerun. That's kind of fun.
Oh, and I have to mention how Ka also is a huge inspiration on, again, Robin Hood snake. Like the same facial expressions, the same sort of postures. I don't think it's the same voice though, right? I think they changed the voice.
That might be the case. Yeah.
I'm excited about that one. I really hope that I don't ruin that one for myself.
I'm just sitting here feeling dumb that I made like 8 Beatles references and didn't mention that they wanted the Beatles for the vultures, but Lennon wasn't having any of that. Hey, Yellow Submarine, someone else is voicing him too. So I guess he just was not into the idea of being being animated.
Was this pre-Yoko 67?
It would have been basically, yes. Pre-India for them as well. That was 68 when they went. So I think he had met Yoko. The story with Yoko is they met a couple times, and then she just became like a creepy fan, but she had enough connections that she kept, you know, could be outside Lennon's house all the time, where so she was like, what is this weird woman doing look around? And then eventually finds out that Lennon actually is communicating back with her. So
they're screaming at each other. They're both going, ah, through the window.
I think I was more like 69, primal scream therapy, but
I wonder if he had gone to India first and then was approached to work on the Jungle Book, if that would have changed anything.
That's kind of what I was getting at. I mean, I know they saw Yellow Submarine and were like, oh, gee, we probably should have done our voices in that instead of having, although honestly, it was probably better to get voice actors because they give better performances.
yeah, big time. And like, did this come up before where they approached Stanley Kubrick and they all wanted to be in a Lord of the Rings movie starring themselves, but Stanley Kubrick said that he was busy working on 2001 Space Odyssey. I have a feeling if he wanted to, he would have made time for it. It was probably like, okay, guys, I'm a little busy right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're fine on screen a bit, but
a full 3-hour musical Lord of the Rings starring the Beatles. It probably would have went over as well as the Star Wars Christmas special.
Or the Starlight Express. That's a fun one. Speaking of Starlight things, are you familiar with that?
Oh, man, it's not ringing any bells. Starlight Express?
It's Andrew Lloyd Webber's Insanity musical, which is...
more insane than Technicolor Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat?
Yes, because this one, all the characters play trains, and they're on roller skates. Some are steam trains, some are diesel trains. And I think one of them gets converted to diesel at the end. So that you have the musical where the actors also need to be able to roller skate well. And on top of that, on the story, it's they're all characters from inside a child's dream, and they eventually rebel against the child as the controller of the dream. It's like totally, yeah, it's pretty bad.
I'm getting MK Ultra vibes.
Sure, why not? And there's still a pretty permanent production of this in Germany, which just has pyrotechnics and stuff, and it just sounds completely insane. It's kind of
so speaking of insane, I messaged you about this movie. I've never seen it. Gnomobile. Have you seen Gnomobile?
I haven't, and I guess we're talking Inside Baseball on the cast now, but I was thinking we'll maybe pair that up with Bed Knobs and Broomsticks.
Okay.
It seems like, because they came
it
out.
It blew my mind. Time. Someone mentioned it to me as like a fever dream that they saw, and I was like, are you sure? And then we saw the poster, and it's like, oh my God, that's the kid from, I think it was the son and the daughter from Mary Poppins in it. But yeah, I can't wait to look at that one.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not expecting a good movie, but I'm expecting something really weird.
I'm expecting a movie.
Yeah, I'm expecting a start and an end.
Right. As far as my notes, the only other one I'm already looking at here is that I thought it was weird that the baby elephant is wearing a wig or has hair, and none of the other elephants do. That's just kind of bizarre.
Well, no, there was another elephant that had hair because he gets it chopped off because they're all getting up for inspection, and he gets to like the third or the fourth elephant, and the elephant's hair is in front of his eyes.
In the
military context, it's like you're not allowed to do that. So he whips it back and he shaves it across the top, like, you know, like a true sort of like Vietnam buzz cut.
I mean, I was fine that they wanted to give the vultures like mild, you know, mod cuts. So that made sense, I guess. So do you have anything else in your notes that you really want to dive down? I'll give you a serious moment if you need it.
No, I mean, we got over all the serious stuff. Another thing, too, that's hard to discount is that King Louis might have been based on the Hindu god Hanuman, which was the monkey god, and a lot of the other creatures that we come in contact probably represented specific gods from Kipling, although they get distorted a little bit through the translation of the actual stories and then Kipling's version and then Disney's version, and specifically Disney's like second version, because the first version was too dark and too occult and too much of like a traditional adaptation of the real book. So through those three or four degrees of separation in Game of Telephone, you lose some of those, but I think King Louis probably stands the most out as retaining a lot of that. And then another one is that him being King Louis and seeking this enlightenment, like that's his goals, he wants human enlightenment through Mowgli. And King Louis was also known as the sun god, associated with, you know, like the rising sun and Prometheus and, you know, like Luciferian sort of sun god, starlight worship, enlightenment. So again, King Louis, I think, is an interesting tie here. It represents a lot of probably most of the original story kind of coming through.
Yeah, I guess it would have made more sense if you had like chimpanzees in that role, but then you couldn't have it take place in India. So... You know, I'm just thinking, oh, like if you're going evolution wise, it's one, you know, just one step away from humans. They just need this one thing. That's the 2001 thing. They touch the monolith, and you now have fire or tool making or whatever.
Yeah, now you've got the bone that's going to kill everyone.
Well, yeah, the tool instantly. I mean, one thing I think now it's becoming more common knowledge, but when the bone, you know, jump cuts to the satellite, that is a nuclear silo satellite. So you're seeing,
yeah, and represent, because that bone is the one that he used to beat his fellow monkey to death,
right?
So when they zoom in on it, it's weapon. Like here's the evolution of your tools, but it's still just made to just destroy things.
If 2001 has some flaws, that would be one that is not clear. You're looking at a nuclear satellite in that shot. You have to know. But yeah, as far as the Jungle Book, I mean, there's, I do think this is probably an upper tier just as far as watching it. Did you see the remake from a few years ago?
I fell asleep in it because it was like, yeah, no. So no, yes, but okay. No.
Yeah, I just saw it once, like, you know, short, probably when it first came on disc. And I do remember the temple in that one kind of sticking out as just being relatively spectacular, at least. I wouldn't have been thinking about the occult aspect watching in like 2015 or so, but maybe a year or two later I would have. But.
Well, I think like a lot of those Disney movies, they're the remakes, they're visually astounding and they're okay to watch, but they don't capture, it's like, why did you remake it? Because the original was as good, even if not as visually impressive. But I think that this, the animated version, right, the 67, it probably jumped up a couple ranks. I don't know where it was in my original list, but it's at least a it at least raised the same amount as Sword in the Stone dropped, for sure.
I put this in the upper tier. Yeah, the remake, I do remember not hating it, but not liking it. And then the next one was The Lion King, and that's where I kind of drew the line. I was like, wait, what's just animated again? What are you doing? And the shots are the same. So I never watched anything past the Jungle Book remake as far as these live action ones. Although I might
have. So you still haven't seen Cruella?
Correct. I might hate watch Pinocchio. Like, and if I want to be really sadistic, I won't.
It's honestly not even interesting as a hate watch. If you're talking about the Tom Hanks one, the new Tom Hanks one, it was like, he literally phoned his performance in. It was just like they made an AI model of him and they caught him early morning while he was on the toilet. And they were like, Tom, can you just do your lines now? And he's like, I haven't warmed up. I haven't practiced the accent. They're like, it's all good. Just read it over the phone right now. And he just did it in a sitting.
All right.
It's I didn't like it at all, man. Guillermo del Toro one was a much better, but man, it disappointed me because I didn't want a musical. I wanted like a cool Guillermo del Toro sort of creepy Pinocchio. But it seemed like he tried to inch closer to Disney in his remake, which was, I don't know. Neither of the remakes were impressive. Into
Uncanny Valley more.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Like they both went in the wrong direction. They both should have gone in like opposite directions, but it's like they're trying to meet in the middle somewhere.
Oh, well. Well, next time. They'll never stop remaking Pinocchio. It is one thing. Why does like every director want to make Pinocchio so bad? Kubrick also thought about it.
Really? That would have been kind of cool.
Yeah, I think, well, AI, right? He was working on AI, so I guess that was his evolution of Pinocchio.
So the original script for AI specifically was talking about a homunculus and that Pinocchio, I mean, Pinocchio is a homunculus. He's literally a soulless vessel that becomes animated and serves as this companion to this old alchemist, right? Like we already saw the movie. I love Pinocchio so much, man. But that one is such a direct reference to it. And Kubrick's version of AI/Pinocchio, yeah, it was gonna bring it down to almost like an alchemical manuscript. Like he was gonna drop some medieval grimoire style knowledge to this movie. And in some conspiracy circles, which I tend to be part of sometimes, is that was taken away by Steven Spielberg and intentionally watered down and occulted almost as like a black mass inversion of Kubrick, of like, screw you, I see what you're trying to do here, and I'm going to do the exact opposite just to, you know, as like this act of astral spite so that you feel it in the next world, you know, how much I've slighted this creation that you're going after. And then I'm going to say that it was done in tribute to you. Ha ha. You know, like eat on that one.
And we're cutting 20 minutes out of Eyes Wide Shut. Who knows what was
in that? Yeah. And on top of that, just for what you tried to pull with Eyes Wide Shut, I saw the director's cut, buddy. Guess what?
So yeah, I actually revisited that one several months ago and yeah,
that's Eyes Wide Shut.
Plays way different now than it did in 99 or whenever it was. So
yeah, post Epstein it plays way different.
Yes. It's definitely a crazy vibe movie. I think when it came out everyone sort of hated it, but it seems to have now been I've heard people say it's like Kubrick's best. I would never say that, but yeah.
I want to believe that somewhere on the cutting room floor there might have been Kubrick's best movie in there, but it's definitely not the one that got released. Although it is interestingly a Christmas movie, so it could make some, family some top 100 Christmas. Yeah,
That and Die Hard, right? Because I think Die Hard is now it's your obvious if you say that's a Christmas movie. So,
I mean, my favorite one has always been Gremlins, and it probably always will be Gremlins. Although I have to say, man, we're getting into modern here, but Violent Night, which came out at the end of last year, is easily top three Christmas movies of all time, of all genres.
Maybe I'll have to hit that. No, we on my sci-fi podcast, we actually did Gremlins as our Christmas movie last year. So
I mean, it starts at Christmas, like all the major plot points revolve around it being Christmas. Like there's multiple Christmas related deaths, right? There's one where they kill them with like the Christmas tree lights, and man, it's a Christmas movie. It starts out with the old lady holding the frosty head and bringing it into the bank and yelling at everyone. So
also Prometheus is a Christmas movie. That's fun to think about.
Is it, or is it just happen while there's snow?
No, they make specific references to it being Christmas in the movie.
Really? Okay. I've watched that.
Yeah. Actually, I did. We got Gordon White on for a podcast where he made a very strong case that that's a Christmas movie, and I bought it. So,
okay, now you're peddling.
Yeah. But I guess we wrap this one up for today. Everyone already knows what we're doing next because we talked about it 5 minutes ago. So, but in case you fell asleep for a few minutes, that's Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. And then what's the gnome again?
Gnome Mobile. And Gnome Mobile. Yeah. This one I haven't been able to, man, maybe I can give you some homework, because if we can find some more information about this, it will be unbelievably fascinating. But apparently Walt Disney had some connections to the Bohemian Club, right? The Bohemian Grove. And the Gnome Mobile takes place in Redwood Forest. It's not necessarily the exact same one from Bohemian Grove by name, but the way this movie came up was because apparently he was friendly and might have attended a couple of them, but that there was another special technology that he was working on, and he was going to do a movie projection in a Redwood Forest somewhere. And this might have been he might have been specifically working on like a special Bohemian Grove Disney extravaganza, like for their eyes only type of projection system. And it just, I don't think it ever came to fruition, and it might have spurred some of the disconnect between Disney and Bohemian Grove, where he then started the Rancheros or the Valleros or something, like his little Western secret society club, where they were going to take things more seriously than those guys over at the Bohemian Club did. So I wonder if there's anything at all that like intersects his rift with them and this rumor that I just heard for the first time a couple weeks ago, but that Walt Disney personally was working on a special projection technology that would work in the Redwoods. And that sounds like a Bohemian Grove play. So okay. I don't know if you could find anything at all about that. I'm morbidly curious about it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a good teaser for what we'll get into next time, I guess. But it's now, as far as the listener's concerned, it's March. So what's up with you?
Oh, speaking here in March, let's see. Oh, I've got a new comic that should be at least available to sign up for a notification on the website on paranoidamerican.com. It's called Mold, and it's a story about a lunch lady who gets revenge on these nasty kids at a school that she works at, and also becomes the conduit through a nasty case of toenail fungus that connects her to the original mycelium superorganism that controls the earth. So this old lunch lady talks to the original bioform of Earth through her toenail fungus, and it helps her get revenge on nasty kids.
Okay. I'm thinking about Mold.
So it's a real big Disney sort of adaptation. We're marketing it towards the Disney crowd.
Yeah. I did think several times in this movie, like, what does Mowgli smell like? Can't be good. So... I guess you should shout out where people get that.
Oh yeah, so paranoidamerican.com and @paranoidamerican on Instagram, and then lately I've just been going hard in the paint on memes and AI, and I've got a whole bunch of like AI Bidens and Clintons and all sorts of stuff. And I also have been taking my American Cryptids coloring book, which is by far the most successful book in our entire catalog. And I've been taking the coloring book pages and rendering all those out with AI and all kinds of weird and creepy and cute and realistic renditions. So if any of that strikes your fancy, yeah, definitely check out the Instagram page.
Yeah, I just take a step back from the AI myself. It's getting a little weird. Although I did make the podcast artwork for this podcast with the AI. That's called Disney. I guess I'll just go from that into a plug. Other ones we do at Podcastius on Patreon include Imprisoned in Prison, another prisoner podcast. Artwork is made with AI. What else made with AI? Time Enough podcast about the Twilight Zone. I made that one with some AI. So I did use it. I used my 1 week trial quite well. So, but yes, if you could support us on Patreon, you keep the lights on and the Zoom up, I guess. Okay. I'm going to run into the rice fields, not the jungle, but I'm going to do something along those lines now.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeMess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.